I think it was 1939 when concert pitch came in to play, when all instruments have to be tuned to an A, you know, concert A or whatever.
I've even heard debate in recent, and it was funny because it was on the Guitar World Forum, about that A440 mm-hmm. wasn't even a standardized.
That's
maybe
right.
Until then.
That's right,
then,
until 39, I think.
And then some people
imagine
still
that. So everybody's playing different.
436
that's right.
Or something.
When I naturally tune the guitar, I always tune it flat. Semitone, exact semitone flat. So my pitch is always underneath.
A half
something
step?
Like, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. And funny enough, I found out after doing a lot of research, most of the instruments were tuned slightly flat in those days as well. Yeah. So there might be a connection there. It just seems to be more natural. Jimi Hendrix played flat.
Exactly.
You know, that's why he could get such a great vibrato. Yeah. Yeah. You know, you got that flexibility on the string.
Right.
But you can't play with a keyboard player.
Right.
You can.
Unless he plays in different keys. Well, there is, since you bring it up, there is something... besides the sound and the feeling of an E flat versus an E of a Stratocaster when it is mm-hmm. tuned down a half step, there is something
yeah.
about the response of
exactly.
the instrument that it definitely is different.
Yeah, it's almost like it wants to be down there. It wants to be flat. Yeah, then you tune it up and it's a little bit harder to play and bend notes.
That's true.
Unless you've got banjo strings or very thin strings,
right.
which that was an interesting story. Back in 1963, I was playing on the Brenda Lee show in England. I was in the band that was backing most of the artists. And this guitar player he was telling me about James Burton, who played with Ricky Nelson. And he knew him personally. He said, oh yeah, James, he uses banjo strings.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course, and you were a big... Am I interrupting
no,
you?
No,
you
no.
You were a big fan of... like Too Late and those Ricky Nelson records, isn't that
oh, yeah,
true?
Yeah,
I think
yeah,
I read
yeah.
that
oh,
somewhere.
Yeah.
That was an influence.
And it's amazing how the guy tells him, so I put banjo strings on, bending them, and I'm like, oh, this is fantastic. But then my whole guitar went out of tune, and I was the basic guitarist to back everybody else. So they all complained after the first show. It was a mad, you know, two shows. They said, put bloody new different strings back on your guitar. You know, because I was so out of tune backing these other musicians, these other singers.
Right, right.
I did a great solo, bending all the notes, but they didn't come back to the... like, oh, then I'd play a chord, and then all the singers from that point on were not amused
right.
you know, with my playing. They all insisted that I put normal strings back on for the next show.
But you probably didn't.
Mm-hmm. I had to, because it was so embarrassing, because I'm like... No chord was right, you know, it's dreadful.
Really good for soloing, though.
Yeah.
Well, I had read that Hendrix, you know, because in those days, of course, the availability of strings was so different.
Right.
That he would use the A string of a banjo for his high E.
Really? I didn't even know that.
Because
yeah.
it was the finish, probably an 8 or a 9, I don't even know what, because it had to be tuned up to A.
Yeah.
It was 2.5 steps higher.
I'm not sure.
Normal. And I play with Dickie Betts.
Really?
Allman Brothers. I'm in
yeah.
his band. Been in his band the last 4
yeah.
years. And,
I used to listen a lot to the Allman Brothers back in 69. So a lot of what Purple did was influenced by the Allman Brothers.
Really?
Yeah. We were really influenced by Vanilla Fudge and Mountain. And of course, Hendrix. A little bit
I didn't know you were influenced by Mountain, though. Leslie
yeah.
West, I'm a
yeah.
big fan.
Just love this stuff.
And
I remember being in a place in Germany, and Ian and I were out drinking and just sitting in this club. In those days, you could go to a club and listen to all the records. Not like today.
Right.
You just can't go anywhere unless you come somewhere like this.
Right.
Pace and I, and we heard Mississippi Queen.
Right.
And Ian Pace and I just kind of went white. Like, who the hell is that?
Yeah.
It had this such a big sound.
Yeah, right.
I said, go on in, go and find out. Ask the DJ who it is. Group called Mountain. Who the hell is Mountain? But Mississippi Queen, what a sound. The three guys. You know, that da 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 da.
There is keyboards in there that's very, 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 very quiet.
What?
There's keyboards.
Oh, is, yeah.
When they go, and there's a little keyboard lick, do you remember? It's about that big.
Yeah, of course, could be.
The guitar is this big.
Yeah, yeah. But it certainly came across well.
Frightened us to death.
Mm.
Leslie Weinstein, he's from...
Yeah.
He's from Queens.
Is that his name?
Leslie Weinstein. Oh, he's hilarious. Such a good guy.
We've done a few tours with him, Purple and Mountain. And every now and again, Leslie would just walk on stage, unannounced, plug in his guitar and start playing. And the band would be in the dressing room. But he's on! And they'd run onto the stage. He then would walk off. You know? It's like madness.
Right.
So I kind of like that about him. It's that eccentric thing. You know?
Right.
And he plays with more or less three fingers.
Yeah.
He doesn't bother with a little finger. It's like, it's all there.
Right. Oh, great vibrato.
Yeah, that's right.
But, you know, just talking about the thing about the strings and the thin strings, as I heard that that's what James Burton did.
Yeah.
You know, moved the B string over to the G string because you couldn't get it unwound G in those days. And Dickie said that was a revelation. He saw a guitar player, the Chuck Berry thing. And he saw a guy playing and he was like, how, you know, like this isn't possible.
Yeah.
And then the guy wouldn't tell him, you know, like what he was doing.
Yeah.
Didn't want him to see his guitar.
Of course. Yeah.
And Freddie King, I had heard he used his strings, his top three strings were a 10, an 11, and a 12, which is really weird.
Yeah.
But
I used a 10 on the top, but then jumped to a 12 and a 13.
I know, that's really pretty crazy.
I've jumped to, sometimes I use 14 for a G and sometimes 13. But, you know, like someone like Jeff Beck will use all really fine high top strings and really deep bass strings, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Right.
So everybody to their own. I just like more an even kind of feel.
Right. I had read somewhere you said something about when you did in rock, it was because you had decided that you wanted to get more sort of heavier rock sound. Had you done the concerto?
Yeah, we were trying to find our way as a band. Some sort of category. John was into the classical stuff, and although I love classical, I said, you know, let's do a real rock thing, out and out rock. If that doesn't work, let's go back to playing with orchestras.
Right.
And that's how In Rock came about.
Hearing like, it's like say a song like Speed King and the Trades that you do with John Morton and the scales and the modes and what you're playing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's tremendously innovative. And for a young guitarist, I mean, you couldn't hear that anywhere else. It was really, I mean, that was tremendously groundbreaking. So, as a broader question, can you say something about your interest and perhaps how it ties into what you play today?
Yeah.
Into unusual scales and modes and just the musical influence of either classical music or whatever, you know, led you in that direction.
It was classical. I'd, the age of 15, I saw a band that did all rocked up classical tunes called Nero and the Gladiators. They happened to all dress in togas and, you know, and if you told someone that, they'd go, oh, that must look really silly. But it worked. They just look so different as a band. Hence, since then, I have to be in a band dressed up as something, whether it's a Roman or a musketeer or something. So I first saw that band, Nero and the Gladiators, and everything they did was like by Grieg. They rocked up Grieg, or they did Jardas, Monty Jardas. They did
all
these.
The Mountain King,
yeah, that's right. They did all these tunes, and that's what just, to me, tweaked my interest. I went, I want to do that. I want to play all the classical tunes rocked up. So I thought in a classical vein. I was obviously into rock playing, but I liked the classical overtones. And so not many people were doing that at that point. If someone was playing classical music, they were doing the orthodox, you know, Julian Bream, Segovia, or they were into rock. I like kind of the two. I always felt excited by that music, any sort of classical music that was rocked up, even if it was by Mozart, Bach being my hero, it just moved me so much more than just the blues. You know, I like the blues too, but I always found that I could only go so far listening to the blues. It's another blues, you know. I'd be more excited hearing Mozart's stuff or Bach stuff played in a rock and roll fashion. But it was very interesting. That's where it really first came from, that Nero and the Gladiators.
So you were 15 then?
Yeah, now, I was 15.
But were you already a fan of classical music and had been exposed to Bach? And were you trying to play those things on the guitar?
I was 11. My dad said to me, if you're going to learn this guitar, you're going to do it properly. I'm sending you to lessons. So I went to classical lessons. I wasn't very good. Apart from the fact that every time I went to my guitar teacher's house, I'd fall off my bike. So I'd always arrived bleeding. You know, it was a bit like Monty Python. I'd get down the end of my road and I'd fall off my bike with my guitar, because I'm holding my guitar and trying to steer, and it was snowing.
That prepared you for a life on the road playing rock band.
Yeah. So I'd always arrive, you know, either or not. Some days I'd arrive and the teacher would go, "What are you doing here?" And I'd go, "It's guitar day." He said, "No, it isn't. It's tomorrow." Oh. So then I cycled, you know, about 10 miles to his house. Went home. Another time I'd come back and he'd go, I can't teach you today because my beer is blown up. And he was standing in about 6 inches of beer. His beer that he was making had exploded. And then another time, which is a great story, I was playing, reading music, and, you know, getting to grips with the guitar and that, and I had a cold. So as I'm playing, I didn't want to stop playing, and my nose started running. But now I'm trying to concentrate and play, and the teacher's watching me, and my nose is now dripping down here, and I'm trying to put it in, and this mucus is all coming out. Thank goodness he said, "It's all right, you can stop and wipe your nose." I went, "Oh, okay." Like, that was very embarrassing.
That's it. What were you playing, though?
I was trying to play Kavot by Bach at the time. Was that?
He was teaching you classical technique.
Yeah, that's right. And a bit of plectrum style, so it was a bit of both. My musical lessons kind of started to fade out at that point, because every time I arrived there, he said, "Have you been practicing this week?" And I go, "Of course I have." He goes, "No, you haven't." I go, "No, I haven't." "Well, go home. I can't teach you unless you practice." I wasn't practicing.
So you didn't really practice?
No, I just wanted to hold the guitar and kind of move around in the mirror, you know, and be like Tommy Still, who was my idol in those days. He was an English guy.
Yeah, sure, I've heard of him.
And that's why I got the guitar. I wanted to be like Tommy Still.
It's cycling 10 miles each way.
Oh, yeah. I cycled everywhere in those days. That's why I can kick a ball. You know?
So when did you really, you know, start to dedicate yourself to playing?
It's about a year in. When I was about 12. I got to about 12 and started to... It was very stuffy. These guitar lessons were all like... You know, I wanted to play like Buddy Holly. You know? I didn't want to play Canoe Waltz particularly. You know? Boom, jing, jing, boom. I can remember it now. And
so you had an affinity for classical music, but because rock,
it came
rock
a bit later.
The...
Yeah, it came later. The thing for classical came about 4 years later. I was just playing anything by Buddy Holly and Duane Eddy.
Right.
I would listen to Chet Atkins, Merle Travis,
sure,
which I was completely flummoxed by, as Malcolm would say. No one could understand Merle Travis. It's like so intense. And Django Reinhardt completely lost me.
But you were a fan?
Yeah, I was a fan. And then Wes Montgomery. And realized that I better stick to the simple kind of playing, because I'm not going to be... I could never understand where they were going. You know? But I appreciated their technique. So amazing.
Well, I think that's one of the things that really set you apart. Again, you know, because I'm such a fan, and I go back to when I was 15,
yeah,
1971, and I was sitting there with my Jimi Hendrix and my Cream and my Richie Blackmore and you were, you know, the thing was that you had developed this technique and the sound and a touch and all of these things that when I got a little older and started listening to more players, I think, well, you know, this is more like there's a discipline here that maybe you could draw a correlation to a classical musician or to a jazz musician.
I used to practice a lot. From the age of about 14 on, I was practicing a lot. I suddenly clicked into the guitar. And I know later on my musical teacher was very impressed, you know, because I think he thought I was a complete idiot. You know. But it took a while. I'm the type of guy that takes a while to learn something, but sometimes I can turn out be better than the next guy because he'll pick it up so quickly, but it'll take me twice as long to pick something up, but I'll be compulsive and I'll just zoom in on it until I get it, and then I'll be like manic, just keep practicing and practicing and practicing.
Right.
Where the other guy's got it, I'm going to do something else, but I was always very intense in what I wanted to do. So I think that's part of my character, isn't it? Being intense into whatever, you know, I want to kind of get into. You know. Whether it's research or kicking a ball around in soccer or whatever, I have to really get into it.
Right.
Can't just do it as a... I like to study it and try and figure it out. So.
Did you have any... a sound in your head, or was there a point at which you felt that you were sort of finding
I think my biggest
finding a sound that was representative of your personality? Some guys say that they don't even realize something like that until way later after they're very famous.
Yeah, I think what happened was, it was interesting, I was terrible at copying people, so what I would often do is make up my own stuff just to compromise. I'd be like, I can't copy the solo by James Burton, so I'll make up my own. So that's the only time that I would actually I could never copy properly. If something was slightly involved, I'd just make up my own guitar solo rather than my friends I used to hang out with. They would copy every note and I'd go, wow, that's great. But it seemed to pay off in the long run, because then all of a sudden I was playing stuff that I wrote, and they would be kind of lost, because unless they heard it played by somebody else, they couldn't copy it, so they couldn't make up their own stuff.
Was there a point in which where you heard a sound, where you said,
no,
this?
Not really. I was always after the sustain. I used to, when I first left school, I worked in a factory, and I was trying to get my, I would often talk, it was an electrical place, and it was all about, we were making stroboscopes and things like that. And I would always ask the top guy, I said, can you make me an amplifier that distorts? And, you know, I'm at the age now of 15. I want an amplifier that distorts. And they were like, we're trying to make amplifiers that are clean, and you want distortion? You're nuts. And I said, well, just, you know, how would I go about making an amplifier that would distort? Now, I know a little bit about electrics and all that. Well, I mean, it could be done. I mean, and I said, could you make me up a little box that would distort? And of course, they would, I mean, you're crazy, but I'll make something up that, why would you want distortion? They couldn't understand. You know? Okay, just make me up a little box. And I also used to, there was another one, I had a Vox amplifier, and I used to, I actually cut up my speaker. I remember getting a 3-inch speaker and putting 30 watts through it and cutting up the speaker cone so it fuzzed.
I have to ask you though, like what year is that? Only out of curiosity.
That year would
was
have
it
been
61 or 2 or something?
Yeah,
or?
No, it would have been, that would have been 1961, yeah. Okay. 61. That's right, 61. I used to do sessions way back when I was 17, and I'd, whenever they wanted a certain effect, I used to go through this 3-inch speaker carved up with a razor blade. The producer was very bemused by the hell I was doing, but he used to mic it up. Right. He used to get the...
But did you just take that upon yourself?
Yeah.
And the only reason I mention that is because Dave Davies from the Kinks talked about, you know, jabbing a knife into his speaker.
I didn't even know that.
Because he, you know, he said, well, I want to make noise. You know, it's not noisy enough. They did the concerto, and, you know, it was a rock band playing with it.
That was kind of an experiment, and that was John's world. It wasn't my world. I felt very awkward because that was... I should have done 24 bars with the violins behind me. And, of course, I ended up doing something like 52 or something. And the conductor was like, when is he going to stop?
Oh, you're talking about your solo?
Yeah, that thing in concerto. So I even messed that up, you know. The conductor, he had to bring in the violins after my solo, right? And he was just hovering. We now enter the 52nd bar. Wow. It should have been over at 24. When's he going to stop? Of course, the violinists are all going...
Some of them were smiling, I saw it on YouTube.
I mean, they're smiling because they knew it was a joke. I first got into this type of music that we're doing now when I probably heard at the age of 9, Greensleeves, sung at school by this choir boy, and I went, it just moved me so much and took me back to almost another time. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, it's been at the back of my mind. And of course, it revolves around the harmonic structure, which is like parallel fourths and parallel fifths.
Right.
Exactly the stuff you'd hear being played by Sean. It was the cousin to the oboe, but it was the forerunner to the trumpet and that kind of thing. Back in the 1500s, 1400s, 1300s, they used to play wooden Sean. So I love all that stuff.